Change with Dr. Zara Larson here at the Southern Arizona Horse Expo. Of course, I had a great pleasure of hosting Alan Barden and the debut of his new painting called The Celebration of the Horse, and then just spent a really fun hour with master storyteller, amongst other things, Bill Mumy, also from Tucson. So let's segue here for this next half an hour, and a real pleasure to welcome again on our show, who had the pleasure of actually capstoning my 100th show in this radio career of mine, amongst other things that I do, and that would be Mr. Michael Blake. Thanks for joining me today.
Well, you're welcome, and I'm happy that you're having me.
That's great. Well, it's got quite a lot of buzz going on here over at the U of A, and you feel like you're in your element with all the horses, right?
Well, I've always been in a horse element of one kind or another, and I'll be speaking about it today, even though myself and a woman from Colorado are going to be speaking about wild horses and the situation with them. I'll be talking to these people who have been involved with horses probably most of their lives about my own experiences with domestic horses, which I started with. But the wilds, when I started to have experiences with them, it took me to a level that I'd never been at before.
Yeah, that's right. In fact, our 100th show, of course, we were delving right into the new book you had then released, which was memorializing your wild herd stallion 12. It was called 12 the King. And boy, the emotion that you shared with us then, and then here we are now with that horse.
It's interesting because, Zara, I've been, you know, going around the country, the American West, all of 2009, and people, whether they're horse lovers or horse owners or not, people who have experienced the reading of 12 the King have not told me, oh, you're great, but just that it had a very deep impact on them to read that book. And that's why I wrote it, was to share my experience with this animal. With people, and also to give people that don't spend much time with other animals an opportunity to see what can happen.
That's exactly right. Well, of course, I would mention, I think we said at the beginning of the show, Alan Martin's painting, of course, has there in the clouds 12 the King. So there's that spiritual element of that powerful beast that was part of your life, as well as your horse Samantha, who I understand now is probably with him in horse heaven, her passing out at the end of the year.
She followed him. They were adopted together in 1991, and by myself, and I spent 18 years with Samantha, and I think we talked about it before. She was remarkable. It's like bringing someone very special into a group of beings to teach them about the earth and about life on earth. And Samantha did that with numerous domestic horses that spent time at my place and taught them all kinds of things that they didn't really know. As great as it is for horses to be trained and to be put together with human beings, at the same time, with a lot of domestic horses, it makes it their life rather
patterned, constrictive, not nearly the freedom they had.
Not nearly the freedom, but just human beings treat animals in different ways. So it's like not being in the wild, and a lot of domestics that I've been involved with didn't know whether they were going up or down.
Yeah, but it's interesting your comment. It's highly unusual, isn't it, for a wild horse to indeed endear herself or himself to the domestic horses? But it's also probably a testimonial to her essence of being the mare, the mother, the guide.
Absolutely, she was captured when she was 3 years old, and the director of the BLM up in Nevada that I knew at the time thought that she had been a herd mare, even at her young age. And Samantha is it was similar to human beings in the sense that even though she was female, she could have been male too, but she had different observations about things that she put on people, period. Mm-hmm. And she put them on the horses, for sure. Taught them where to walk, taught them what to eat and not to eat, and as I said before, even taught them to groom each other, mm-hmm. which you know, that means you don't have to groom your horse, you know?
Well, in fact, your one comment to me was, oh, that man could take more lessons from the wild horses in this day and age, that the stallion protects, the mare, you know, inspires and has that familial sense, and they actually raise their children together.
They raise their children together. A mare is picked in a herd to do leadership. She will have the rest of the herd follow her to water, to food, to a secure area to spend the night. And the herd stallion follows behind to defend them against anything that might be coming up. And together, all of the herd stallion and all of the mares raise the youngsters. One of the great things about 12 that's not in the book that I recall was that when my children were very, very young, just had been walking for a year or two, we would take them down to the barn to visit the horses. But at that age, you didn't want them running around any horses, because if a horse got nervous or jumped or something like that, they could have their arms broken or, you know, be knocked down. 12, the wild herd stallion, had raised so many of his own youngsters that even though he didn't want to be in touch with human beings, when the children were around him, he stood absolutely still.
Beautiful.
And he was the only horse that we let them move around anytime. They would crawl under his stomach. They would pull on his tail. They would hug him. They would do all these things to him. He would never, ever move a step.
That's
because
right.
He knew what they were.
That's right. This is Zara Larson, my guest, of course, and actually dear friend I'm so enjoying to getting to know is Michael Blake. And most of you would know Michael as a screenplay writer and involved in the movie industry, having done Dances with Wolves as well as other film-based projects. We're talking now about his lifelong commitment and enraptured with horses and the reflection of him. Michael, I have now in front of me, of course, your latest book that's about to come out called Into the Stars, and it has a connection to the equine world as well. Tell us now about your new book.
Well, it's a different kind of book. It's not about Indians. It's not about history or anything like that. It's about a young man from Michigan who goes into World War I, and he ends up in Europe. And because World War I, like unfortunately all of the warfare that humanity has, was a disheveled, completely disheveled experience for everyone, and he ended up behind enemy lines. And I had never planned it ahead of time when I started writing it, but what happens to him behind enemy lines is he's trying to find a way back to the American forces, and as he does try to find a way back, he goes up on a little ridge after he gets out of no man's land, and there are trees and birds, and he can lie down and take a nap after nearly being killed multiple times, and something wakes him up, some sound, and he looks across the ridge, and in the trees there's a horse.
With just a
bridle on it, and it seems to be in good shape and all of that, and he connects with this horse, and the horse connects with him, and they stay together for the rest of their lives, and together they make it out of the war, which destroyed so many horses and so many people.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's that's a story then that continues on and carries on, that his story as he's wraps forth further.
Yeah, and it's it's not Into the Stars is not really so much about a guy and a horse. They're just together. It's really about what happens when we go into warfare, and how little really is ever achieved from warfare, except the dissipation of people and their families and their future lives.
Yeah, that's right.
I was in the Air Force for 4 years, and I knew a lot of guys that had been in Vietnam, and even those of us who were military Confederates, nobody ever talked about it after they came back, because the experience of warfare is so severe that to talk about it after you're done with it only brings it all back.
It does.
And most people just want to forget about it.
What's interesting, though, as I think about the various circles of your life and your career, your interests, the movies, the writing, the horses, obviously, you're wanting to take strong statements and share compelling things about the future of the world, the future of our country, is that you're pulling all these strands, though, in a way to help people move forward. So this isn't about staying rooted. It truly is about moving forward.
I think it is. You know, honestly, Zara, my feeling my whole life has never been about achieving notoriety or achieving wealth. My feeling at the basic root of everything that I've done, whether it's working for the public or writing books or doing films, whatever it's been to try to give any kind of inspiration that I can give to people that are coming behind, because I think creative work, whether you're doing things with radio like you do, or writing books, or making movies, or making music, what it does is, that is what, in my view, moves humanity forward in a very strong way, is creative work. Because that gives people feelings, not of just earning a living, not of just raising their children, but feelings of having life being something really, really special.
And you use that word connectedness and continuous as well. Well, to that point, our listeners should know that when Michael's book appears, it isn't just about the written word, of course, but it's your beautiful collaboration with John Sully, who did the paintings throughout. Tell us that story.
John Sully, like many, there's many people here in Arizona, in Tucson, Arizona, who are marvelous painters, including Alan and Bill, who you talked to earlier. And John Sully was a gentleman who was in Hollywood for over 20 years doing posters for films. Then he started painting. And when I finished this book, Into the Stars, I gave it to him uncorrected, and I was just hoping that maybe something could happen. And I told him, you know, if you don't mind reading it, and if it feels good to you, maybe you could do some drawings for the book. Mm-hmm. Because I think that books need more than just words. At any rate, this one did. He called me back in 2 or 3 days and said, Michael, this is fantastic. I can't do any drawings. I have to do paintings.
Oh, my word.
So he did 19 paintings.
19 paintings.
The cover and 18 chapters, and did a beautiful job. And I think it's wonderful to... In the old days, there were books that had drawings or paintings in them. That really doesn't happen much anymore, except on the cover. But Into the Stars, no matter what happens with it, who publishes it, or how it comes out, it'll have John Sully's paintings.
That's lovely. And so that's the phase you're in right now, is actually approaching different publishing organizations?
Correct. I have a manager now named Peter Rackman, who I had met in the early 70s in Los Angeles when I was working as associate editor for the Los Angeles Free Press. And he represented at that time huge musicians and film stars. And we got together, and then he left Los Angeles, went to New Zealand, and made boats and became the biggest corporation in New Zealand making boats. But he came back, and I saw him for the first time in 40 years, and we got together again, and he wants to move forward, and I want to move forward, so we hooked up.
Well, what an interesting phase you're in then, compared to, I think you told us a story about how when you wrote Dances with Wolves, and for those who aren't aware, that actually Michael was living in his car through that whole phase, moving different locations around Los Angeles and letting this story come out of you, that when it came time to wanting to publish, that you got turned down by everyone that you approached, right?
Well, not only was the book rejected by every major publisher in the United States, but then when Kevin Costner finally read the manuscript, which he had told me to write in the first place.
There you go.
But he was, it turned out later that we found out that Kevin was hesitant to read it because he was afraid he would like it so much, he would want to make it, and it would be impossible to make it. And but he did read it, and he called me up and asked me to come back to Los Angeles and write a screenplay. But even after that, every single film company rejected the idea of doing it. And because it was Indians, and because it was the West, and because it was historical.
You said that one firm, if I recall, said, well, maybe we will, but, you know, we need the Windians to speak English.
Correct.
Which would have been sacrosanct, absolutely sacrosanct.
And Kevin and I have been close for many, many years. And when I came back to Los Angeles from Bisbee, is actually where I was, washing dishes at a Chinese restaurant. When I came back, I went straight to Kevin's house, and we went out on the porch and actually sat down on the grass. And the first question I asked him was, Kev, what do you think you're going to do about the wording? And he said, oh, well, we'll just print stuff underneath. And I said, great. And we never talked about it again.
Isn't that something? And again, for those who follow the film business, and certainly Michael's amazing career, you'll know that actually it was that film that, because you and Kevin got rejected so many times, Kevin said, fine, then I'm going to create a company. And every movie he's done since then has been through his own firm.
Yeah, that's what he did. And when we went to South Dakota to shoot the film, I probably told you before, but I think I could repeat it for those who are listening now, is that we went without one penny from anybody in America. We started shooting Dances with Wolves with about an 80-person crew and a ton of actors with $7 million that had been advanced by overseas distributors. Mm-hmm. That's how we started that film. So Dances, like many other films that have been made that people still like to watch, were made independently. Were made despite the feelings of where's the money from, you know. Our capitalistic system is wonderful. It's brought us out of caves, and it's brought us away from having to hunt elephants and things like that. But at the same time, it's removed us so far from what the reality of life on Earth that it's put us in trouble. The things that are happening, like in Haiti recently, you know, I think the Earth is starting to change because of the huge populations and all of the stuff that's going into the atmosphere and all of the stuff that's affecting water and so on and so forth. And I think that we're going to be battling to keep this earth moving. And
what you see at the same time, though, wouldn't you say, is just in this week and a half or so since the crisis, though, is the outpouring of compassion and the reawakening of the need to help our fellow man.
I think that's really essential. And I think it wouldn't happen if things like this in Haiti or other places didn't happen. And the fact of the matter is, too, it's a deep feeling I have, is that this downturn of our economy actually has made a lot of people, maybe not the majority, but a lot of people think in terms of moving in a little bit different path, in a path that's more basic and more realistic than the path that we've been in. And if we can do that, I think my children, the children of all other people, will have a better opportunity to lead a really great life on Earth than they have now.
Said, I think the other piece of it, too, is a lot of people are reflecting about taking more greater joy in the present and appreciating that which they have, because there are so many people that don't have what we have, whether it be this country or our different backgrounds, but also this idea of shifting from success, however you define success, to true significance. And so I can see, you know, Alan Barden's painting, Bill Mumy's commitments to his art and bringing things back, yourself and your writing, is that it's also this time has opened up a prolific nature amongst all of the creative people, I feel, or people that even have had that bottled up in themselves, that now it can come to a new place.
Well, I have two young people right now working as my assistants. One is 20 years old and one is 26 years old. And I want to not tell them exactly what they need to do. I just want to give them the opportunity to have some experience and maybe have some inspiration. And I think that's working very well. So that's why I love to be connected with not just people who have achieved everything, but people who are coming up, because it's essential to give them the feeling that, yes, I can do something with my life.
Mm-hmm. But also give them the freedom to make that life what it is that's right for them.
Absolutely.
As opposed to some predetermined script or thou shalls or thou shalt.
Absolutely. And as I've said frequently, and I'll say it again today, the Wild Horse 12 that I spent almost 15 years with me, taught me essentially death doesn't matter. It's connected with life completely, and it's inevitable, but it doesn't matter. The life you have, the time you have on Earth, is the only thing that matters, and use that time.
Absolutely beautifully said. Well, Michael Blake, thank you very much for joining us here. Of course, folks can find any number of your beautiful 8 books, is it now, or 7 books, an eighth to come, out on Amazon, as well as take advantage of your film and movie, but also come back over here to the Arizona Horse Expo and hear Michael talk and share with us further insights on the wild Mustangs. Thanks again for joining us, Michael.
Oh, I thank you.
Very good. Stick with us here. We've got one half an hour segment. You're going to meet Dr. Jim Hill from J.B. Hill Cowboy Boot in El Paso, Texas, but also the original owner of Seattle Slough. Thanks for joining us here on Circles of Change with Dr. Zara Larson, 104.1 The Truth, FM News Talk Radio.